Hey, you got the morning show with Aaron, that's Lost Tribe Aotearoa with Reflections. And in the studio, I've got Finn Mackesy. Good morning, Finn.
Kia ora. Good to be back.
How you doing?
Yeah, I'm good.
So we do a thing now where every few weeks we talk with Finn about permaculture. Finn, you are a permaculture teacher. Is that how you describe yourself? If someone says, what do you do?
I wouldn't say as a career that's how I describe myself, but it is definitely a part of what I do, yes.
Part of what you do, and it's part of what we're doing here.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah. Mm. So do you feel you've absorbed the all about permaculture into your soul now? And it's a slightly strange question, but...
Yeah, I think I understand the question, though, is I'm always learning, and so I certainly wouldn't say that... I guess that is part of permaculture to my mind, though, too, is that I'm kind of a lifelong learning journey.
Yeah.
But I do feel like I've integrated the ethics of and principles of permaculture in such a way where it does influence how I think and act in the world. So it is part of my makeup now.
Yeah, and you do... Every time I talk about permaculture in terms of plants, you always make sure I know to expand it to building... And behavior. Yeah, right. I think it's important to keep reiterating that because other people will probably, I don't know, what did it start with plants or did it start with ecologies?
It did very much start with, I guess, both of those. But yeah, so permaculture came from permanent agriculture, which was that whole idea of perennial system. So forest gardens.
Yeah.
So it definitely has its roots in food production and in land-based systems. But over the last, whatever it is, 55 years now, since Permaculture One came out, it's expanded quite significantly.
Okay. And you want to talk today about design because that's key to all of this, I guess.
Yeah, all it of those seems different to be one uses. Of those. Yeah, I think it's a key element of the essence of permaculture is around design. And design's one of those things that is kind of amorphic and means different things to different people.
Yeah. So can you say what design is in that case?
I guess the Simon Herbert and Viktor Popanek kind of line of thinking around design is probably most resonant with me, which is some version of the conscious patterning and of actions toward a desired outcome. So really loosely speaking, it's, I guess, thinking about a desired future state and trying to take meaningful actions towards that.
It's not just another way of saying planning?
Well, so there is a planning element to it as well. Yeah. And I guess often the difference between design and planning, at least from a historic point of view, I think is a spatial element. So often when we're talking about landscape is where do I put the tree? Where do I put the house? Where do I put the pond or whatever else it might be, which is has a planning element to it. But yeah. So I think design for me, though, is...
Is there more of a creative element too?
Yeah, I guess that's part of what that design element is I think there's a few things that make design unique, and creativity is one of those.
Yeah.
I also think there's a range of different skill sets that through the permaculture literature over the years, and you know, certainly design isn't unique to permaculture, that really explore different ways of thinking. And so... it's a bit of a jargony term, but I like the idea of psychotechnology. So what's kind of, in modern terms, is we'd use design thinking as a term. But how do we think about situations and challenges and then draw on lots of different tools and frameworks to help us explore the future and what we want to do?
Yeah, so it is quite an amorphous thing.
It can be, and design means different things to different people. But I can give some concrete examples.
Yeah, let's go for that.
But I guess taking maybe two steps back is where what we talked about last time was after Permaculture One, the first permaculture publication in 1978, is Bill Mollison kind of took permaculture to the world and founded the permaculture movement.
Yeah.
And David Holmgren took a step back and went, I guess, kind of almost Bush, as it were, but tested a lot of his ideas and thinking. And particularly, he went into a deep rabbit hole around design process, and testing some of that. And so design has been one of these things in permaculture that's been contentious. And there's a man named Dan Palmer, a New Zealander who recently passed, but he brought quite a critical lens to a lot of the permaculture literature around design.
Yeah.
And I guess the critique there is that a lot of permaculture literature has focused on almost like kind of cookie cutter arrangement of elements. So you take these preconceived ideas. In this situation, you do this,
yeah.
and then that goes there, and then over here you do this, and over here you do that, and you put it all together, and it's called a permaculture design. And so more traditional and, I guess, more rigorous design processes are more emergent. So they're more iterative. So that's, I guess, one of those key concepts of design.
So is that... Is that instead of steps, because what you're describing is you do this step followed by this, followed by this, it's more about principles.
That's exactly right.
So you incorporate this principle, then this principle. Well, maybe not even in order, but
But there is that. And so you're learning by doing. So there's this kind of action learning element is you take an action, you observe the impacts of that action, and then you test and trial and work out whether the things that resulted were because you did it or because some other variable in the system kind of changed or whatever else.
Yeah.
And so there's kind of like a tinkering element, I guess, to typically to design. Whereas I guess when I think of planning, I think of it as more kind of road mapping. It is a very linear thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to do this and then that. And then after that, then I can do this.
And feedback is obviously an important part of it. Because there
critical.
Are, like if you're talking about building design, the person designing your house will probably never live in it.
Yeah.
So there might be a short circuit of feedback there.
That's exactly right.
Which is not good anyway.
Yeah.
And a designer would hope to avoid that, but obviously it seems pretty key there that feedback is an important part of it.
Yeah, and so one of the things that, and I keep coming back to David Holmgren because I guess for me he's the leading light in this space in terms of both permaculture philosophy but also practice. But he, I guess, interrogated this idea of design and what are the qualities of good design. And one of the things he speaks to is, not only the need to test our ideas, but to test our assumptions and to question and go, what am I assuming coming into this situation? And a lot of design thinking literature today has the same thing as, so I guess all design is subjective would be another way of saying it, and recognizing that we can never be completely objective in a situation. And so when we're making observations, own our own assumptions that we're making. And so there's a tendency, I would say, for the Western psyche to assume that when we take an action with a desired outcome in mind and we get the desired outcome, then we assume it was our action. Yeah.
Okay,
As opposed to something else that happened in the system. So for example, we had a very wet summer.
Yeah.
And some of the plants might have done particularly well this year. Many of them did particularly poorly. But again, as opposed to attributing it to, oh, this was because I took this particular action, is maybe it was climatic or maybe something else was happening in the system.
Yeah.
And so there's, I guess, a need to be humble and really observant, I think, in design process. And that's one of the things that David underscores in Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability, where he really... in this first principle of permaculture, observe and interact, where he talks about one of the superpowers, I guess, or one of the unique qualities that humans have is our ability to, again, apply these psychotechnologies, to apply heuristics, rules of thumb, ways of thinking to help us understand situations.
One of the things that's going to happen with, if you're not observing, especially if it's planting and the next summer is dry, you're going to get a slap in the face anyway.
That's right.
Nature will let you know at some point.
And that's where you talked about feedback loops, right?
Yeah. That's an experience that's going to happen anyway. You'll know.
And so on that note, another, I guess, one of those heuristics or design heuristics of too much of a good thing is not good. And so I guess in part that speaks to positive feedback loops. So we think of feedback as, I guess, the information we get from any given action.
Yes.
And from a systems science is there's positive feedback loops and negative feedback loops. And
which is not in the loaded sense, like we negative and positive.
Good and bad.
Strong emotional.
That's right.
But it's a different.
It is different. So positive feedback loops are things that amplify or make some effects more pronounced over time. So climate change is one of those.
Yeah.
The warmer it gets, the warmer it gets.
Right.
So that's a positive feedback loop.
Yes.
Yep. And negative feedback loops are, they bring something back into balance. So they reduce the impact of any given effect.
But can they go too far in the negative?
Yeah, they can, but usually it's so those positive and negative feedbacks are, I guess, living system's way of trying to create balance within the system.
Okay.
But too much of a good thing speaks to that idea of we don't, for example, if we look at modern industrial agriculture, is by using synthetic fertilizers, we were able to increase crop yields. And then we kept using more synthetic fertilizers, and now we're in this trap where we have no other option than to use synthetic fertilizers without reducing yield, at least in the short term. And any strategies to get away from synthetic fertilizer require generally long lead times, transition times, and a reduce in yield over that time. And so that's where you have the, you know, more and more of something good has actually turned out to be quite a bad thing and quite a risky thing.
Positive feedback loops, is that a feature of maybe not our culture, but our systems, our agricultural now? And is that a feature of industrial life, of positive feedback loops?
Yeah, I think in lots of ways it is. So consumerism comes to mind. Yeah. So does debt. And so debt begets debt.
Yeah.
And so those are all examples of arms races, another really good example of positive feedback loops. So, what led to arguably both World War I and World War II was this idea of, oh, we'll protect ourselves by building ever bigger weaponry and military hardware, and then your kind of quote-unquote enemy looks over the fence and goes, ooh, they've got more ships, we need more ships. And then you get to a point where you just have to use them because you've invested so much in them.
And there is an understanding that security, the use of the word security, your country's security is not inseparable from your neighbor's security.
Yeah.
So if you make yourself really secure, then they're not going to feel secure. And I guess eventually there is a negative feedback loop, but that's when the war starts.
Yeah.
And that's where we don't want to be.
Well, so what's interesting is using that comparison of war to food production is something a mate of mine, James Samuel, said way back when that's always stuck with me, which is there's no such thing as food security if your neighbor's hungry. And so that's one of those where there's a negative feedback loop, I guess, in that sense, in that where when I'm holding all the weapons, everyone around me feels threatened, whereas if I've got all the food and other people are hungry, then my own security is compromised because everyone needs food. And so in that kind of more permaculture way of sharing surplus is how do we start thinking about surplus and what we do with that. And how do we create, that's where things like equality and egalitarianism, I guess, kind of play out. Even just from a enlightened self-interest is when people feel threatened, they behave badly. And when people are in need, they'll do what they need to do to meet their needs.
Yeah, that's a feature of our culture. It's become a feature of our culture, maybe built on practical, I don't know how it came about in our culture, but that thing of looking after myself and not thinking about our neighbor.
I think I do know. It's neoliberalism applied to like a neo-Darwinism, that idea of survival of the fittest. And it's justified that idea of, and this idea that it's a dog-eat-dog world, selection at the individual and the gene level. And I guess that's one of the things that I'm particularly passionate about is a multi-level selection or generalized Darwinism. So that idea that selfishness at the group level, the selfish individual will typically benefit because they can kind of get what they want. But selfishness at the group level never works. So when you're between groups, the groups that are more cooperative, more collaborative, always succeed over the groups that are more competitive within themselves.
I completely agree that neoliberalism is a problem in that regard, but I think it was around before then. I think it's been supercharged with neoliberalism.
Quite possibly, but I think if you look to a lot of indigenous cultures, is that idea of I'm more important than my larger social unit. There isn't much evidence from what I've seen to support that. That's not a widely held view. So it is cultural, that value of... in order to meet my needs, I need to think of myself first.
Is it a feature of, should we call it empire culture?
Quite possibly. Yeah, quite possibly. I'm not sure. It might be. Yeah.
We're possibly getting off track here.
Yeah, we are.
How does permaculture address, living according to permaculture principles help us address the fact that we've got a very selfish, ideologically selfish set up at the moment?
Well, so bringing it back to this idea of design and the first permaculture principle of observe and interact is, I guess, recognizing that. Yeah. So there's a value that I've been socialized with that has me unconsciously most of the time assume that in order to look after my family and to meet my needs, I need to look after us first. And so it's, you know, so to take on that kind of competitive and that selfish nature. Yeah, so that's where it starts for me, is that element of, oh yeah, that's right. I have all this, I don't know what I'd call cultural baggage that's unquestioned. But when I actually look at the living world around me, I see examples where actually cooperation is primary, not competition.
Yeah.
And then how do I take actions that align with that that kind of insight and perspective?
So there's a very long discussion to be had about this myth of nature is, was it red in tooth and claw? Was that a quote from somebody, a scientist back in the day, or a philosopher? But you're saying, and I know lots of other people do say as well, that nature is cooperative.
Yeah, primarily. And it's not to say competition doesn't exist, but it's a secondary feature. But I guess for people who are interested, check out generalized Darwinism. I mean, there's the science around this is very, very compelling, that actually cooperation is primary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. That ties into so many things, but I'm trying to keep the discussion back on track. There's been, you're probably aware of the concept of peak oil, and a lot of people's response to that was they were going to move out of the city, find a piece of land somewhere a long way away, create their permaculture paradise, and be completely self-sufficient.
Lifeboats, I think, is what they were called at the time.
And then hope that when civilization collapsed, that not everyone tried to come and get their food.
Yeah.
So there are literally people out there who have set themselves up for that scenario.
Yep.
How would a permaculturist actually try to be ready for a collapse scenario?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I guess from its inception, permaculture was in part, or maybe in large part, a response to the oil shocks of the 1970s. And so there was this sense of, oh, we actually do need to look after ourselves, and we do need to think about a world without cheap energy. And so there was maybe not a collapse, but certainly a consciousness around energy and the role that energy plays in all living systems. So from a permaculture perspective, I guess comes back to the three ethics for me, which is around earth care, people care, surplus share.
Yeah.
And so how do I set up systems and structures that will still be around after a decrease in surplus energy? You know, right now we're in a wash in energy, and you know, you can imagine our ancestors looking forward, if they had the ability, and to be able to see the amount of energy that we use. You know, we use, some of us in a single year, more energy than our ancestors used in their entire lifetimes.
Yeah.
You know, just from a pure energy number perspective. And so the future is likely going to have, you know, fossil carbons we know are finite. So it's about setting up systems now that are future-proof, but also that aren't exclusive or aren't about, you know, I have my piece of paradise here, I have my lifeboat.
Yeah.
And, yep, I'm setting myself up to be able to chuck out some, whatever you call those life buoys, or, you know, rescue rings for people. But no, how do we design systems? And, you know, there's a lot of great stuff happening here in Whangaroa that are part of that, is how do we think at that larger scale? How do we think at the community scale, the neighborhood scale, at the bioregional scale, so that if and when those things do happen, we there's enough resilience in the larger system.
So you mentioned the three ethics before. Are these ethics that permaculture has kind of deduced or seen in nature? Is that where they come from? Is that
So I'm not totally clear on their origins, but an interesting parallel is, I guess, in kind of sustainability theory, is what's called the strong sustainability model, where you have the environment in the kind of outer circle. There's these three concentric circles, and you've got the environment, and then you've got kind of culture and society, and then you've got economics in the middle. And it's not because the economics is the most important. It's to communicate the idea that these are nested. And so, you know, you can't have a healthy, thriving culture or society without a healthy environment. So the environment is the largest whole that we live within.
Yeah.
And then the economy emerges out of, or at least the human economy emerges out of, human societies. and our need to transact, to interact, to have a whole range of different needs met that we can't meet ourselves. And so we start exchanging goods and services. And so there's an element, I think, of a hierarchy within that earth care, people care, surplus share is, you know, we need a healthy, thriving environment.
Yeah.
But I suspect it is about observing what, how kind of nature works and how healthy human cultures work is those values are inherent. I think what's interesting coming back to design is I don't know of any other design theory or design approach that has, I guess, ethics kind of embedded in it.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Is that part of the design process?
It is.
To touch on the ethics?
Yep. They're central. They're always central.
Right.
Yeah. And yeah. So that's one of the reasons why permaculture resonates so strongly with me is there's these ethics that resonate so strongly with me.
Yeah. Yeah. See, I was taught a design process, but I don't remember ethics being a part of it.
No. Often design is quite utilitarian.
Yeah. In a lot of ways,
it's about achieving a means.
We were designing for ourselves.
Mm.
The enjoyment and the enjoyment of design is important.
Mm.
I think you're probably not, if you're not enjoying it, you might not be being creative either. Mm. But it was a little bit about us.
Yeah.
Much given that we were just at the school, we were designing things that weren't ever going to be built.
Mm.
It's probably going to end up that way anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah.
So some of the other, I guess, design principles that I think are core to permaculture is this idea that the problem is the solution. And maybe not super intuitive, but the idea of how can we take a problem or a challenge and kind of flip it.
Yeah.
And I know in some of the regenerative development, regenerative design kind of practices, there's this idea of you have a restraining force and a driving force, and then you have this reconciling force. So how does this, how does the pressure of wanting to do something and the thing that's stopping you from doing it, how do those two things reconcile so that you can actually come up with this elegant response that almost disregards the problem to begin with. So, you know, some of those really common permaculture expressions or manifestations of that is, you know, I've got a slug problem. Well, why don't you get ducks? You know, I have a...
But, okay, that's just a natural reflex for a permaculturist. But why ducks for the people who don't know?
Yeah, and I think that needs to be interrogated even further, but I know it's a common one. But ducks, they eat slugs.
They eat slugs?
They do.
But do they bring their own problems?
Not so much in lots of different ways. I mean, they fertilize. They're noisy. So they get us up. They're kind of, you know, they get up before the roosters do at our place. But yes, so it needs to be considered. So it's not. So that is a common example. In some ways, it's not the best example because it's overly simplistic. But I guess if you're looking at an orchard system and you do have issues with ducks, we have an issue with slugs, then maybe considering ducks is not a bad thing.
Okay.
But that's a common example that's used in terms of the problem is the solution, is how can you flip that and turn the thing that's causing you issues into an opportunity to rethink your system and bring more biodiversity or more stability into the system by just tweaking and changing things.
Right. So that's that. I think that's almost like it's almost at the core of design. You talk about those opposing forces.
Hmm.
The creative part, you need creativity to find that elegant solution.
Agreed.
The one that actually works.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's... Yep. That, to me, is probably what design is.
Hmm. I think the other one for me that is really core is that idea of iteration. So you try something, and then you learn from it.
Yeah.
And so there's an ongoing learning. Like, design is never done.
So and that's easy with a garden, because you go through seasons, and every year the seasons come again, and you can iterate.
Hmm.
But when you're doing something more permanent, like a house, you might not get to iterate.
Yeah, well, and I guess it is about time frames too.
Yeah,
because if you zoom out long enough on the time horizon, that house will compost.
Yeah, and someone, the next generation, will do a better house.
Yeah,
yeah. Okay.
So, but I think your point is really important. Is, you want to get a lot of your built elements right. You know, you don't want to you don't want to experiment with a dam. You don't want to experiment with a house in the same kind of ways. that you might with, a garden or even a type of crop rotation combination or a guild of plants together. You know, if it doesn't work, you can kind of mix it up and try again. So take your point.
But you can learn from other people's experiences.
Yeah, and so I guess that's another of these kind of permaculture design maxims, is failure is fine so long as you learn from it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if it's the same failure keeps happening, you know you're not learning from it.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, okay. So we've gone past 10 o'clock. Did I derail the discussion at all? Because there was all sorts of things.
It goes where it goes, right?
It goes where it goes. Yeah. Did you get across what you wanted to get across?
I think there's probably more to unpack, but you know, we've always got next time. And what I'm keen to do moving forward is introduce the permaculture flower and the broader range of the broader realms, I guess, of design. So, you know, we've talked at the beginning about plants and that focus on land-based and biological kind of elements, but also making sure we talk to the built realm as well as the behavioral realm. And particularly in the behavioral realm, I think, is where the most opportunities exist in terms of how we can live a more ecological life and where we can make the most positive change.
Okay. So the permaculture flower is a diagram.
It's
a metaphor, and maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, so it's got, we'll unpack this, but it's got seven domains or seven petals.
Yeah.
And each of those petals represent, I guess, this kind of more holistic version of the broad suite of design application. So when we're thinking about, I guess, sustainability or a full, rich life, what are all those different domains or all those different things that we need to think about? You know, we can't just think about growing food. We need to think about the tools and technologies that we use to grow that food as well as in other areas of our life. We need to think about economics and finances as well, because those play a huge part in that. We need to, you know, think about education and culture, et cetera, et cetera. So there's all these different realms or domains that are all critical.
Okay.
If we're going to design a pathway forward that is, I guess, kind of holistic and enriching and lively.
Okay, awesome. Folks, we've been talking to Finn Maxey. Thank you for coming in, Finn. And we'll see you again in a few weeks.